Documents show U.S. regulators privately doubt some of the nation's nuclear power plants can withstand a disaster akin to Japan's following the earthquake and tsunami. In internal emails and memos, Nuclear Regulatory Commission members have questioned backup plans to maintain cooling systems in case main power sources fail. A July 2010 memo assessing Exelon Corp's Peach Bottom nuclear plant in Delta, Pennsylvania, concludes that contingency plans, quote, have really not been reviewed to ensure they will work to mitigate severe accidents. The messages were released by the Union of Concerned Scientists, or UCS. In a statement, UCS nuclear expert Edwin Lyman said, quote, while regulators and the nuclear industry have been reassuring Americans there's nothing to worry about, it turns out that privately NRC senior analysts are not so sure. In Wisconsin, a judicial nominee backed by union groups has declared what would be an upset victory in a closely watched race for a seat on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. With all votes counted, Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenburg edged out incumbent and Republican-backed Supreme Court Judge David Prosser by just 204 votes. Prosser's expected to seek a recount. Many saw the race as a referendum on Governor Scott Walker's anti-union agenda. At a victory news conference, Kloppenburg said Wisconsin voters trust her to be an impartial judge.
Their confidence in the court had eroded from the way past elections had been run and from what they had seen of partisanship and distractions of personalities on the court. And they saw from my record at the Department of Justice and from my campaign that I would be independent and impartial. I would help move the court forward away from partisanship and away from personal quarrels.
In Yemen, hundreds of thousands of people marched through the streets of Taiz Wednesday in ongoing protests against President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Members of the Six Nation Gulf Cooperation Council are now urging Saleh to quit in exchange for their protection. Meanwhile, Amnesty International has urged an investigation into the deaths of over 100 protesters in the Yemeni government's crackdown. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in Saudi Arabia for talks with Saudi King Abdullah. It's Gates' first visit since the Saudi government sent troops into Bahrain to help quell a pro-democracy protest. A top Afghan official has corroborated reports that peace talks are underway with the Taliban. Presidential adviser Mohammad Stanekzai says the negotiations have been going on for some time. He's the highest-level Afghan official to confirm that talks have taken place. Critics have raised speculation that the claims of reconciliation talks have been exaggerated as part of a public campaign to sow division within the Taliban. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets in over two dozen cities across Mexico Wednesday to demand an end to drug-related violence. The Mexican poet and novelist Javier Cecilia called for the demonstrations after his son Juan Cecilia was murdered along with six others in the city of Cuernavaca last month. A demonstrator said Javier Cecilia's call has inspired Mexicans to speak out.
This civil expression is for everything that we have been suffering in Mexico. This upheaval that is not ending and needs to stop. Unfortunately, the violence in Mexico is something disproportionate. It is something that shouldn't be happening. It is enough for us, the citizens. We are fed up with this truly not having any end. The incident in Cuernavaca, I believe, has been a wildfire that unfortunately has us saying enough already.
The demonstrations came as dozens of bodies were discovered near Mexico's border with the United States. Mexican prosecutors say 59 bodies were found in a series of graves in the state of Tamaulipas. Over 37,000 people have died since President Calderon declared a war on drug traffickers in 2006. The U.S.-backed Israeli military continues to carry out attacks in the Gaza Strip. On Wednesday, two civilians, including a pregnant woman, were wounded when Israeli warplanes bombed areas in northern Gaza. A Gaza resident's home was damaged in an overnight strike.
It's a shame. It's the second time already. May God help us and send people to help us. I have children of 3, 4, and 5 years old, and the glass showered on them, and they couldn't see anything. This is the second time, and we pray to God and the people to help us and stop this thing.
And the U.S. government has begun deportations to Haiti after a two-month freeze. The deportations initially resumed in January, 1 year after they were halted in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake. But the freeze was reimposed after a Haitian national died of cholera-like symptoms just weeks after he was deported, and several other deportees also fell ill upon their return to Haiti. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it's issued revised guidelines to focus on Haitians convicted of violent crimes and who are repeat offenders. But critics say the first wave of deportees will mostly have already served their prison sentences without further incident. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. This week, Republicans unveiled a budget proposal for 2012 that cuts more than $5.8 trillion in government spending over the next decade. The plan also calls for reducing the top corporate and individual tax rates to 25%. Meanwhile, Republicans remain locked in an impasse with Democrats and the White House over a budget to cover the remainder of 2011. Last night, President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner met to narrow their differences in order to avoid the first government shutdown in 15 years. But they failed to come to an agreement. On Tuesday, Speaker Boehner said Republicans might now seek up to $40 billion in cuts, around $7 billion more than both sides had discussed over the past week. Failure to agree on a budget would lead to a federal government shutdown beginning Friday at midnight. President Obama blamed Republicans for the political stalemate.
After weeks of negotiations, we've now agreed to cut as much spending as the Republicans in Congress originally asked for. I've got some Democrats mad at me, but I said, you know what? Let's get past last year's budget. Let's focus on the future. So we've agreed to a compromise, but somehow we still don't have a deal. Because some folks are trying to inject politics in what should be a simple debate about how to pay our bills. I mean, there's stuff in all kinds of issues in there, abortion and the environment and health care. You know, there's time to have those discussions, but that time's not now. Right now, we need to just make sure that we pay our bills and that the government stays open.
Well, according to a recent article by our next guest, this budget is unveiled at a time when 1% of the people in the United States take in nearly a quarter of the nation's income.
Of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%. That's the title of an article by Joe Stiglitz appearing in this month's issue of Vanity Fair. The piece discusses growing inequalities in the United States. Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor at Columbia University, author of numerous books, most recently Freefall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Nice to be here.
So, of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%. Explain.
Well, the point is that there has been this growing inequality, not only in income, but actually the inequality of wealth is even much greater. There's a shrinking of opportunity. It's not just that the people at the top are getting richer. If they were getting richer because they were contributing more to our society and everybody else was doing well, that'd be one thing. But actually, they're gaining and everybody else is decreasing. In fact, right now, it's not just the bottom, but even the middle, the median income, half above, half below, are poorer today than they were more than a decade ago. So all the growth that has occurred in our country over the last decade or more has gone to the upper 1-2%. At the same time, there's really shrinking opportunity. And we used to think of the United States as the land of opportunity, Horatio Alger, anybody could make it. And we used to think of ourselves as different from old Europe, as we used to call it. But the statistics show otherwise. Now, yes, we have some dramatic examples of people making it from the bottom to the top, middle to the top. But the statistics look at, you know, what happens on average. What is the chance of somebody at the bottom making it to the middle or the middle making it the top? And right now, we are worse than old Europe. This is something dramatic that has happened over the last 30, 40 years. And what's really happened is old Europe has become more of a land of opportunity. They reformed their education systems after World War II. They said that they recognized they had a problem, and they changed. Meanwhile, in the United States, we've wound up with a more fractionated society, one where moved more to a private education system, where those who have money can get a really first-class education, but the average American is not. And the, you know, those who come out of those education statistics that came out not long ago were show that on average Americans are doing more poorly than countries around the world. And wait, this is related to some of the issues that got raised in the context of the financial crisis. Remember the discussion about the bonuses? And that's related to the same idea. The question was, if people were getting rewards for contributing to our society, a theory that was in the 19th century called marginal productivity theory, then you could say, okay, those who contribute more should get more. But what we saw in that crisis was that these titans of the financial industry got mega bonuses while their companies were making mega losses, and while they were, as a result of their actions, our economy and the global economy went in to a real tailspin from which we have still not recovered. Well, their salaries have recovered, but not the rest of us.
Well, Justin Sartash, given this trend, as you say, it's been going on now for decades, we've been startled in the last few months by Democrats at both the national level and some state, the local levels, further increasing the bonanza of this 1%. We had, obviously, in Congress, the extension of the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy that were supposed to be eliminated. And here in New York State, we were startled for that the new Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, abolished a millionaire's tax that had been instituted a few years earlier, so that in both ends, if you are a multimillionaire in New York State, you benefited from both the federal policies as well as the recent state policies. So,
and that was Democracy Now, which you can find, all you computer listeners, since unfortunately that's all you're getting right now. We are not on the air yet. We still have fond hopes of getting on the air soon. But you're listening to freakradio.org, Free Radio Santa Cruz, on the stream. And if you want to hear Democracy Now, which is what I believe you were listening to, you can go to democracynow.org, and you can hear the whole show, Jeremy Scahill and the rest, at your leisure, because it's archived there. And it's actually something I listen to every morning, or at least I tend to read the transcript. It's quicker that way for me, and sometimes I listen to it too. So you're tuned to the stream of freakradio.org. Coming up next is Bathrobes Piers Broadsides 6 to 8 for the next 2 hours. I will be interviewing, playing interviews, I should say, from Arden of Jabberwock, Roger Mensch of the Hemporium up in Felton, and a variety of other folks, which I've gathered through the last week or two. And you can also call in and comment on issues which I raise, usually about criminalization of the poor, the drug war, police abuse, anti-war issues. There's some protests coming up this weekend and next Monday, which I'll be mentioning and discussing a bit. So stay tuned.
So hard to explain. Yeah, boy, now that's blues. you get from waiting. But the meanest blues that be, they're the kind that I got on my mind. The blues that are the meanest kind of blues my naughty sweetie gave to me. Now the blues you get from swimming when you see a lot of women and you haven't got a bathing suit yourself. Blues start to flicker when you want another liquor and some golden drinks are off the shelf. As the blues keep you getting on the dock when you think a little boat's gonna rock. Blues keep you getting in the tax cab a petting every time you hear the meter jump a pong. Now there's the blues you get from crying when your uncle bills are dying and the afterwards forgets you in his will. Blues you get from kisses when you're walking with the missus and another lady says,
"Hi, Bill."
I want to make you hot and make you really want to shiver. I want to make you want to end them all in the river. That's blues my naughty sweetie gave me.
I'm the sea of Arabia. Your love belongs to me. At night when you're asleep, into your tent I will creep. The stars that shine above will light our way to love. You rule this land with me. I'm the Sheik of Arabia.
I'm the Sheik of Arabia. You're lonely, you're lonely, the girl, you don't belong to me. Let me tell you about that name, mama, when you're asleep, blot it down. Into your dead eye dream, making love all over your ceiling is splashing on the wall. And I love you best of all. You rule this land with me. I'm the Sheik of Arabia.
Scare them from my house.
And that, as you might imagine, is a cut called Sheik of Arabia, Bless Blues My Naughty Sweetie Gives to Me, from Ann Feeney's If I Can't Dance, It's Not My Revolution. As mentioned before, you are proudly listening to freakradio.org, which you can contact by phone at 831-427-3772, 831-427-3772. I'm Robert North, and the name of the show is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, as all faithful listeners already know. Hey, I don't have a guest in the studio today, but I am trying to catch up on some tapes. Going to be doing a little delicate tape playing today from interviews I had with Arden of Jabberwock. For those who don't know, Jabberwock is a kind of a combination glassware, guitar, and clothing store, sort of a hippie-ish type store, which is still currently situated on Cathcart Street between Pacific and Cedar Streets. Next to Taqueria Vallarta, kind of. I think there may be an intervening store. And it's a store that's got a lot of 60s-ish stuff, a lot of rock posters. Got a lot of... there's a pipe shop in the back, which is accessible only to those over 18, or maybe it's over 21. I'm not sure exactly what the sign says. But it was... it's been targeted by the police and also by thieves and also by the landlord. And I've been really concerned about the fate of the owner, Arden, who was gracious enough to grant me a lengthy interview and also to give me access to some of the interviews of her staff who faced police interrogation. It sounded like it was done without a... Miranda warning. and a police search that was apparently a warrant was granted without really probable cause because you had two youths who, according to Arden's account, were thieves who stole more than $4,000 worth of glassware and other property in a nighttime break-in that the police were not successful in solving, but that her friends were successful in solving and were able to essentially catch the thieves with the merchandise. They were turned over to the police, and they then told a story to the police that the police used as a basis for getting a warrant to search the store. And that has resulted in Arden's feeling besieged, and she's put up signs that say 20 to 40% off, store closing, sale, that she feels like she's being driven out. And I really was concerned about this because Arden, who I don't know very well, and I haven't been in the store a lot and been a big customer, but I've noticed that they seem to have a tolerant policy towards street people hanging out in front of the store. And I haven't heard a lot of criticism of the store. It seems to me like a counterculture store is being driven out of Santa Cruz. They apparently drove her from a previous address because they didn't like the smell of sage. The tenants below or above didn't like the sage smell coming out of the store and didn't like people hanging out nearby. And I see a kind of a gentrification drive by different businesses, by the police, by the city council, by the downtown association, by the hosts, to change the character, the traditional character of Santa Cruz, and make it more of a conservative commercial community, which I think I don't want to see happen, frankly, and I've been talking about that for decades on this show. A decade and a half, to be exact. And so I'm going to play a bit of this. Not all of this interview, because unfortunately Arden at the current time is facing felony charges of, I guess, providing glassware to a minor. And that means she has to go to court, she has to get a lawyer, she's being pressured to take a plea, the plea bargain, even though by her account she is not guilty of anything. And it's a difficult scene. So I'm only going to play, I guess, some of the tape around the background to some of this rather than the actual events, because tapes like this can be used by the prosecution and by the police against the person in court. Even if the person in court chooses not to testify, the fact that she's granted an interview to somebody on the radio makes it public property. So I have to be cautious, frankly, because of my sympathy for her. I think, based on what I've heard, I don't think she's guilty of anything either. But sometimes innocence can be turned into guilt by clever prosecution tactics, and that is something I don't want to happen in this case. So I'm going to be reserved about using this information. I don't want her to have to incriminate herself, and I don't think she does incriminate herself. So we'll see her. He'll hear some of what she has to say. And we will see what we can do with that. If anybody has any thoughts, if anybody's had any experiences similar to what Arden has experienced, I encourage them to give a call. We could talk about these issues on the air, 427-3772. It looks to me like the drug war is in full bloom in Santa Cruz, in spite of the mythological liberal patina or cover or fig leaf that is in front of the actual police iron glove, iron fist, and it's nothing new as far as I can see, but it's depressing every time it rears its ugly, ugly head. Whether it's the destruction of the Measure K Commission, which was originally passed supposedly to make marijuana use by adults in private property the lowest enforcement priority, and that police would be monitored on this, and that, of course, was destroyed by a combination of the city attorney's action and by the city council's essentially staffing this with a pro-police person, Tina Scholl, as well as ignoring the concerns of the initial chair who and vice chair who resigned in protest that the city council was refusing to fulfill the mandate of the original Measure K, and also didn't really want the police monitored. And now we've had a situation where they've stacked the whole commission with pro-police, looks like even a drug war people who claim to be interested in legalizing marijuana or making it more reasonable, but who actually are doing just the opposite. You know, they're sort of leftovers from United Way, and the creator of the downtown ordinances, the inspiration behind them, Candy Jackson of the former Jackson's Shoes on Pacific Avenue, an unfortunate right-wing collection of people who haven't even been able to get together a quorum to meet. So the Measure K Commission has not met, essentially, with a quorum in a year. That's my understanding. It's really kind of a joke, an outrageous joke, and that what's happening with the way that police are increasing the number of marijuana arrests in Santa Cruz. The last report to the Measure K Commission from 2009 showed a 50% increase. It's a 30 to 50% increase, I believe, in the number of marijuana arrests, showing that the drug war is being pursued vigorously in Santa Cruz against marijuana possession, not against meth, you know, not against cocaine or crack or heroin, all the bad drugs, though my point has always been the whole idea of arresting people for use of these drugs, sale of these drugs, possession of these drugs, is futile, stupid, vicious, escalates the problems that it claims to go after, and is a politician's pretext for jumping on a drum and, you know, ranting on election eve about crime in the city and so forth. It's not something that really addresses real problems. Similarly, going after a head shop like this is an ideological part of the culture war against people in Santa Cruz who are counterculture. That's my belief. So I'm going to play a little of the interviews I've had with Arden and with others in the situation. And you're welcome to call in 427-3772 and talk about these issues.
It's April 3rd, 2011, about 5 after 4. I'm in Jabberwock. I believe that's the right name.
Yep.
And a colorful store, combination music and head shop. But I've noticed the sign on the store says 10 to 40% off, so you're having a moving sale.
Yeah, we're being kicked out of this place. After 6 months of being here, the landlord has decided to tell us that they don't want pipes here. So we are figuring out where our next alternative is. But we're dealing with a lot more than that.
So this tape is going to be interrupted because we're in the middle of a business day. It looks like you're getting a substantial amount of business today, maybe because it's a sale or maybe because of other things. Have you been getting a lot of business the last few months?
It's on and off. You know, we've worked really hard, spending a lot of time, you know, advertising by putting up a lot of flyers and having people stand at the corner all the time to let people know where we are. So it's taken a while, and now people know where we are and they love our store. And now we're having to figure out where to move.
Now you have a lease, or you have how much time do you have to move?
Well, we have a 2-year lease, that, you know, is a year and a half left, but the landlord, if we want to continue to sell pipes, he wants us out of here, you know, by the end of the month.
And can he do that under the lease which you agreed to?
I don't fully think so. So he's willing to work with us. So he wants to know what we need to get out of here, and he wants to help us get out of here.
And again, it's interesting, to help us get out of here, not to fulfill the lease, which is working with them, but in the course of I've had a number of discussions with Arden. What she told me was that, and what the landlord, I heard him say on the phone when he was calling in, some real estate property company, not quite sure who it is, that They were threatening a 3-day notice under a claim that she was engaging in illegal activity, which the basis for which is she's gotten a felony ticket for allegedly selling glassware to minors, paraphernalia to minors. Whether A, that was actually done, because there's a sign that says you have to be over either 18 or 21 on the back section of the store. B, whether glassware anyway is a form of illegal sales to anybody when it's sold as glassware. C, whether the people that claim that she sold to them, these apparently two youths who are principal perp suspects seized by the police as being responsible for the break-in to her store and held in juvenile hall and then came up with this claim against her, whether these are actually credible charges, credible people to bring charges who themselves are being threatened with grand theft charges by the police and who therefore may be under some pressure to cook up stories about her store in order to satisfy a police department that seems very intent on creating criminals where there are none around the whole drug war situation. These are all questions that came to my mind as I heard this issue being discussed. The idea that a landlord is going to cut her off a lease that she's already agreed to, a monthly lease, where she has an option to continue for another year and a half by threatening her with 3-day notices and she's going to take her to court and so forth. The issue is whether she's breaking her lease, and nothing she's done so far looks to me like she's breaking any kind of a lease, although I haven't read the lease carefully. I'm not an expert in landlord-tenant law. I just know what sounds to me like an attack on, a concerted attack on a head shop suddenly in an era that's looking more and more repressive and right-wing around this incredibly bogus and vicious drug war that many of us have been trying to eliminate from the whole public scene as an incredible attack on the Constitution, attack on people who are trying to live their lives. If they choose to use drugs one way or another, that's their issue, not anybody else's. It's a corrupting power on the police departments, on politicians, on city attorneys. It's just something that's really, really bad. I think a majority of people, and even still in the city and county of Santa Cruz, oppose, and yet the police department seems to be intent on, and landlord seems to be intent on enforcing.
So, you know, basically I think he is willing to offer us, you know, funds to try and help us get out of here. I think our biggest issue is that we got raided by the cops yesterday.
And I want to hear about that. Before I do, though, would you sign in, please?
I'm sorry?
Oh. What's your name?
I'm Arden Russo.
And this has been your store since its opening?
That's correct.
And you were previously at another location in Santa Cruz?
Yep, we were off on Cedar Street where they had rented to us but didn't want us to have people playing drums or burning incense. We burn sage incense, which is strong, and the women above had a law office, and they said that the smell would go right up there, and she felt like she was allergic to the sage. She also didn't want us to play guitars on the same steps or play drums inside the establishment or have people hang outside the establishment. Of course, I know that the landlord of the place sat and hung out outside the establishment every day before they rented it to us, and now the new tenants have people hanging outside the front of it every day as well. So, but that's, you know, not my problem and situation. Right now I'm having to figure out, A, where I'm going to move, and B, how I'm dealing with these false allegations made by the police, who their allegations were given to them by two gentlemen who are underage who decided to give allegations saying lies that I would actually provide to young people under 18, which I never would.
And this, of course, is what I was saying before. And what I'm hoping to do at some point is I was encouraging her. Already she's in this, when this conversation with her happened, which was 4 days ago, she was sort of assuming that she would have to move. She was assuming that she had no choice because the landlord was advising her that it was her responsibility to move, that they could eliminate, they could sue her in court, and she didn't move, and that they give her a little bonus if she did. I pointed out to her that generally speaking, as long as you're up on your rent, your landlord can claim you're breaking a lease, but her lease allows her to sell glassware. And if the landlord had had a problem with that, then the issue should have been raised when the lease was raised, that the glassware, with the exception of pipes, perhaps, or with the exception of items that could be used for cannabis smoking or anything of that sort. Cannabis smoking, I remind you, which is quite legal for people who have medical marijuana cards or recommendations from doctors, and therefore it's not an illegal operation at all. Now, there may be laws that prohibit selling paraphernalia to minors, and that, of course, is the issue that it looks like with the police, and I have not researched the law under which she was arrested. She wasn't really arrested. She was just ticketed, but in which, in essence, she is being intimidated into leaving town by a combination of police and landlord pressure, or moving at least from this location. And I told her that I would advise her not to be intimidated by this, to at least consult with an attorney to find out a number of attorneys and look at her rights as a tenant, and also her rights as a person, as a citizen, because her account of the story, which I'm going to kind of pass on secondhand, I think that's the best way to do it, is, as far as I can understand it, that she was, they called her up, they told her to come down to the store or they would come and raid her house, even though they had no search warrant for her house, so they weren't telling her the truth. They told her that when she got there that she had to talk to them. This is, I believe, Officer Barnaby Clark who told her this, and that was the account at least that I got from witnesses who were there, that if they didn't talk to her, they would take her down to the station and she would face serious charges if she didn't talk to them. In other words, they didn't advise her that she was a suspect, in essence, functionally under arrest. She couldn't leave. And that she would have to, that she, in fact, had the right to remain silent. She had the right to have an attorney present. None of this was told to her. Now, there's some people who say, I wasn't told of my rights when they gave me a ticket. Well, police don't have to tell you your rights when they're writing you a ticket. They do have to tell you your rights if they're questioning you. That is simply the decision of the Supreme Court in the 60s on this issue. It's been weakened by subsequent courts, but it's still the case. And it's the basis for evidence in court statements by people who weren't told that they have a right to say nothing, who weren't told this, and so they made incriminating statements to the police or statements the police wanted to use in a trial, which the judge said, no, forget it. You can't do that. You didn't advise them. You intimidated them. You didn't advise them they had a right to remain silent. And for me, this is particularly important when the police show up in these completely bogus drug war raids, because this seems to be a significant proportion of what the Santa Cruz Police Department and other police departments throughout the state and the country are doing these days. Completely illegitimate function. It throws the police into disrepute, rips up the Constitution. I mean, I've been through this, and you listeners have probably heard this many a time. It is a form of prohibition that was tried with alcohol, and people generally agree, although there's some controversy about this, that it failed. And it was not, it created a bigger problem. We have not yet been able, although in California we've passed Proposition 215, to end the drug war end the drug prohibition war, which is really what it is, and deal with the whole drug abuse problem in a better way through medical approaches to the whole situation and through public education. But there are communities like Santa Cruz who know about this issue and who are at least to some extent, although not so much as they were in the past, and that's unfortunate, fighting against this. You used to have large numbers of people who would come to the Board of Supervisors and denounce the sheriff for getting funding from the feds for these helicopter flyovers. I don't think that's happening as much as it was. We used to have organizations like WAM who are active in doing this. Now that WAM has gotten its little piece of the pie, it doesn't look like it's too concerned about these issues. We still have Americans for Safe Access, which is working around this issue. I'm going to take a brief musical break, and we're going to be back with more interviews around the issue of the what appears to me to be an incredibly illegitimate raid by the police on the Jabberwock pipe and clothing and sundries store on Cathcart. It actually has a Pacific Avenue address, but its entrance is on Cathcart between Pacific and Cedar, the raid that happened on April 1st. And it was no April Fool's Day raid. Maybe it was done by a lot of April Fools, but it was quite serious. And when the police tie you up in court with this kind of stuff, it involves huge legal expenses. It allows a hostile or nervous landlord to come down on your head. And it creates a whole situation in the community where it's going to be hard for you to set up an alternate business. If anybody has any comments on this, please call in, or any information, 427-3772. 427-3772 is the call-in number. And again, sorry we're not going out on the actual radio. We hope to be doing that soon. I do hope to be doing it soon. I don't know how soon it's actually going to happen, but I hope it does happen soon. You can still call in, 427-3772. 427-FRSC is the number to call.
First they ban abortion, birth control is next. Then comes sex when you're not married, finally out goes sex. Put the prayers back in the schools, install parochial, allow for corporal punishment, and then you've got it made. We're going back, back to the good old days when men were really men and women knew their place. We're going back, back a couple of centuries, and welcome back the days of the theocracy. The family is so holy, there must be no divorce. If a wife is not content, she must adjust, of course. If he's forced to beat her, it's all for her own good. She must know what her limits are, as every woman should. We're going back, back to the good old days when men were really men and women knew their place. We're going back, back a couple of centuries, and welcome back to days of the theocracy. The next to go is daycare. It's all a commie plot. What could be more fulfilling than a child wanted or not? A woman's work is housework. God wanted it that way. A salary degrades us because we shouldn't work for pay. We're going back, back to the good old days when men were manly men and women knew their place. We're going centuries, and welcome back the days of the theocracy. They teach us women's lot is love, honor, and obey. Though their crusty notions seem like jokes to us today, they are sitting in our capitals and the White House and the Supreme Court. They'll be voting on our lives. If we don't stop them now, our freedom will not long survive. No going back, back to those lousy days when men were really masters and women were their slaves. Let's move ahead, ahead for future centuries and build a world that's based on true democracy, and build a world that's based on true equality.
And that was Anne Feeney singing Days of the Theocracy. 427-3772 is the call-in number. Let's hear a little more from Arden of Jabberwock and her ordeal with the police and landlord recently as they attack her store, her head shop, in the what is another kind of reefer madness in beautiful Santa Cruz. Yes, here in Santa Cruz it's happening. Which you didn't read about in the Sentinel. The Sentinel apparently didn't bother to cover this story. Or any other news media that I've heard of.
Figure out, A, where I'm going to move, and B, how I'm dealing with these false allegations made by the police. who their allegations were given to them by two gentlemen who are underage, who decided to give allegations saying lies that I would actually provide to young people under 18, which I never would, and I would never provide herb or anything to anyone underage, and I would never provide herb for anyone over 18. I do smoke for my own medical purposes. I have sleep apnea, and if I don't, I actually could find death being my next morning, and I really would like that not to happen. So, yes, I do smoke, and I actually need to smoke to survive. Beyond that factor, I have some false allegations that scare me and create more stress for me and possibly create more of a risk for my sleep apnea, because stress is actually what's really bad for sleep apnea. And it is creating a lot of stress for me because they want me to come to court on a felony that if for some reason their false allegations win and they somehow can accuse me of something and somehow win, even though I never did this thing, then I would go to jail away from my kids, and who knows what would happen then. And I have three beautiful kids who would all attest to what a wonderful mother I am.
How old are your kids?
9, 11, and 14.
And what are their names?
Zen, Ananda, and Cliff.
And let's go back. I understand there was a break-in to your store some time ago.
Yep, just 2 weeks ago we had a break-in by the same two young boys who are accusing us of doing these false things, and those two boys stole over $4,000 worth of my inventory, which the police, by the way, spent little to no effort at trying to get them. We spent 120% of all the effort to try and get them and had to hold their hand the whole way if we wanted anything to be done about it.
How were they eventually found out and captured?
We kept having continual people, because everyone cares about our establishment, come in and say, oh, well, we saw this person with glass that night of the thing right outside Woodstock Pizza. We saw them with backpacks full of glass, and they gave us free glass, and we noticed that it was your glass. And so then we tried to get videos from Woodstock, and we know that there would be videos from the bank and the parking lot, and we let all this be known to the police officers, and then we got pictures in the future from the brother of the person who did it, saying he definitely did it and that he has never been a good person and that he cannot be rehabilitated because this person has done one bad thing after the next and will continue, even if they put him through rehabilitation, to do one thing bad after the rest. And so this person is now had been taken into custody finally by the police after us giving him successive pictures and giving him all the different witnesses and everyone and being interviewed.
Who was the officer in charge of the investigation?
Officer Barnaby Clark.
And was he particularly difficult to work with or unresponsive?
It seemed like he was responsive the first couple days, and then after that, I think he must have been gone, and so he must have been away, and so he didn't respond to the messages, even though, like, he gave me a cell phone, and so I'd sent him pictures, and right away when I sent the pictures, he said, got it, but when I sent him further messages, he never responded to those. When we had them in here, we called the police station, but they didn't get here quick enough to get them. And
so in other words, they came back to the scene of the crime later?
Several times.
And did you have any dialogue with these two?
I had dialogue with Cody. Cody came in and I said, oh, you're the person that stole from me. I have pictures of you and I've been told that you stole from me. And he said, oh, no, I would not do that. And he accused two people named Chance and Ton. And I followed him. He told me to follow him to the levee, which I realized was stupid of me because maybe I
would
get killed. But that was at 4:30 or so in the afternoon, maybe 5-6 days ago. And I followed him down there, and the people he wanted to show me were gone, and there were some other people hanging out in the same spot. And I don't know. When I got back to my store, everyone confirmed for sure that he definitely was the thief and that he was seen with plenty of the glass. And then I had other people who had conversations with him and that will vouch to the conversations with him that they had said, how could you want to rob from Jabberwock? They're good people. And he said, oh, whatever, fucking hippies, like, you know, and he did not give a shit at all. And so he obviously had a conversation with someone that I could get the interview from that person as well, that says this person definitely, they both planned it. So it wasn't like just, oh, I'm crazy, I'm just going to break in. They actually planned when would be best, and it was a planned, premeditated thing, which I feel, kid or not kid, they need a little bit more than just some slap on the hand.
So when did this theft happen? When did the break-in happen?
Which, by the way, it was over $4,000, so it's grand larceny.
Uh-huh. And what was the more approximate date?
It's about 2 weeks ago. I'm not sure the exact date.
And it was at night or during the day?
It was in the middle of the night at about 2 in the morning.
And when did you discover it the next morning?
At 10 in the morning, the landlord for the place had called and said that the store had been broken in and that I didn't have to worry that it had been boarded up and they don't feel that any other thing other than the window had been damaged. So I didn't rush down right away. But when I did, my employees got here at 1 o'clock. They came in and they said, oh, my gosh, you know that you had got broken in. I said, yeah, but I hope we didn't lose anything. She goes, oh, no, you definitely had a lot stolen. And I came into finding my one clear case completely wiped out. And then the other two cases, about a third of the stuff taken, as well as some new products that were still in the boxes that completely got taken.
Any vandalism other than the broken window?
Nope, it seems like they went completely to the pipe section and didn't touch anything else.
So after that, as I understand it from talking to Wolf on the streets, who gave me an account last night. It was either yesterday or the day before at 4:20 you found yourself confronted by police?
I got a call. I was at my house. I was about to cook an early dinner for my kids.
What day was this?
2 days ago, uh-huh. On Friday. And they said, we need you to come down. We have some serious allegations against you, and we're at your store right now. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I was in the middle of cooking dinner. I mean, how serious? Do you need me to come down right now? We need you to come down right now. Your employees are being held. And so I immediately got down there. I left my house within 2 minutes and took me, you know, I live out of town, so it took me over 20 minutes to drive here. By the time I got here, they were just about done with my two employees.
And I'm going to be continuing. This is a story of the police... the initial break-in by two youths of the store Jabberwock on Cathcart, followed by the police break-in with a legalized break-in, with a search warrant claiming that they are looking for evidence that these two youths were their account was accurate, that they had been sold illegal material. But what I heard. And what you're going to be hearing, I guess I'm going to continue playing this tape on Sunday. But what I heard and what you're going to hear is that the total haul that the police came away with was 4 grams of marijuana from Arden's own personal medical stash of her own. And she wasn't charged with, illegal possession of marijuana. Nobody else, I guess they may have found two. I think there was a claim that there were two other two youths in possession of marijuana as well, possession of less than a gram of marijuana. But this is, these were not linked to her, to Arden. And, you'll often find people on the streets, people come into a head shop who have marijuana on them. It's considered to be a positive herb by a lot of people. Not only does it have medical purposes, but it has recreational value. It's far less toxic than cigarettes or tobacco. The whole nine yards. And the idea that this kind of bullshit is going down in Santa Cruz, this misuse of the police department, this failure of the police department, if Arden is correct, to adequately deal with a grand theft because the police department was occupied, I don't know, giving out sitting tickets downtown or unreasonably disturbing noise tickets for musicians, or I'm not sure what they were doing. That I know the city attorney's office got an additional $225,000 last month from the city council for prosecuting these municipal code ordinances that are so fully and freely used by the police against counterculture people downtown who are just sitting down around and about on the sidewalks of Pacific Avenue in an attempt to move them along, threaten them, intimidate them, and, of course, go after people who are sleeping on the levee, sleeping or assembling in different places where the police don't want them to be, even though their behavior is a no threat to anyone. It's essentially an attack on the basic rights of poor people and people who have no legal place to go. I've talked a lot about the sleeping ban, criminalization of the poor, and indeed there's a protest coming up on Monday, April 11th, regarding the issue of the prosecution of at least seven people for being part of a protest that successfully persuaded the city attorney to alter the law that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep at night. It's not altered enough, mind you. It's still illegal for homeless people to sleep at night. But now, in theory, if they're on a waiting list at the Homeless Services Center, they can get such tickets dismissed, and we'll see if that actually is able to address the issue at all. So far, I believe 45 or 48 tickets have been dismissed, but three or four times that number have not been dismissed. And so those people face criminalization, they face potential arrest and imprisonment, not on failures to appear, because the courts have not been using failures to appear against infractions, but on new crimes created by the Santa Cruz City Council that enable the police and the city attorney to charge people who have multiple, let's say, sleeping crimes, who don't go to court because they think there's no point in it. I've got to sleep tomorrow anyway. I get a ticket tonight. Well, I may get a ticket tomorrow, but that's what I have to do. So they don't go to court, and they get these tickets are so-called unattended. When you get three of these tickets, that becomes a crime of its own, and a crime that is not just an infraction, but that is a misdemeanor for which you can be jailed for up to 6 months or a $1,000 fine. And then every subsequent infraction you get becomes an automatic misdemeanor. So if you're jaywalking or if you're sitting by the side of a building, Officer Winston doesn't like you there and he wants to ticket you, or if you're a street performer who suddenly is using a keyboard, as I heard was being used regularly on Pacific Avenue still, in spite of the a crackdown on people playing keyboards with nobody else complaining, but still cracking down on those things. Or perhaps somebody is complaining. They don't like the sound of a keyboard. Well, I don't like the way certain things look in Santa Cruz. That give me the right to remove merchants' signs and merchants'... If I don't like certain things that merchants are doing, suddenly that gives me the power to harass them. No, but of course merchants and conservative residents and police have the power to do that to counterculture people on the sidewalk. And that's something that I'm going to continue to fight, to see that that kind of abuse of authority and violation of the Constitution ends. And of course it will really only end when people on the sidewalk and people who are poor start getting some real power. And that's a whole big ball of wax how and when that can happen. Anyway, this protest is going to be happening on April 11th. I encourage people to come check it out. It's going to be at 10 o'clock in front of the courthouse at 701 Ocean Street, the same place that Peace Camp 2010 began on July 4th of last year, and it lasted until August when it moved to the City Hall. There was a large bust on August 7th and 8th, and a lot of those folks, at least a number of them, are going to go to court, being defended by attorney Ed Fry and another attorney, Jonathan Gettleman, in the case of Linda LeMaster. And they face a year in, I think it's up to a year in jail. So the 6 months or a year in jail, I was a little bit muddled on that, but it's one of the two. And their crime is sitting with a sign late at night on the steps of the county building and refusing to leave, even though there's no reason for them to leave. They're not blocking any traffic at midnight. They're exercising constitutional rights by protesting the city's criminalization of the homeless and the court's collusion with this whole process. And that was systematically repressed by not just the deputies and the sheriffs, but by the city police. The demonstration moved to City Hall, and the city police and the city attorney and the mayor and the city manager, Martin Bernal, and the police chief, Kevin Vogel, created a lot of new ordinances and laws that made it illegal to be on the property of City Hall after 10 o'clock at night, on the city council courtyard grounds, as they were called, or on the library grounds right across the street where there was a bench where people had traditionally sat on, slept on, hung out at late at night, because there's no reason they shouldn't. The property wasn't damaged. Nobody was being disturbed. But again, it's an attempt to remove, well, in this case, it was an attempt to remove a political protest. But it is now being used, of course, to remove homeless people from sight and from mind, and to make it increasingly uncomfortable and difficult for them to engage in survival behavior, which results in a lot of premature deaths in the homeless community. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert. Your show is on?
Sorry?
Your show isn't on?
Oh, no, my show is on, and you're on the... Actually, you're not on the air, but you're on the stream. You're being recorded and archived even as we speak.
So what is it that's going out from the Free Radio Santa Cruz?
Well,
beam.
The radio beam is actually playing for those who are unfortunate enough to have to hear it. I think it's Air One or some loud station that's coming out of the South Bay area. And it's not, has nothing
boring
to do, unfortunately, with Free Radio Santa Cruz, but it's something that we normally broadcast over because they are, we're us and they're them, and we usually have a broadcast signal. We don't at the moment. Mm-hmm. But we do have a stream, and I've been talking about the break-in at the Jabberwock followed by the police raid, and also talking about your case, Linda.
What'd you say?
Well, I said that you were a dirty, dirty criminal who needed to be put away for your sleepish behavior.
I'm a relatively clean criminal.
Indeed. Well, I know what I was talking about was the protest coming up on April 11th, but maybe I can get you to talk about that since I believe you're going to be one of the speakers there.
Yeah, Becky believes I'm going to be the first speaker.
Well, you should be.
I have to come with my big girl voice on. And well, I hope everybody shows up earlier. They won't get hear my part. Get there at 10 o'clock. It's on the grassy lawn outside of Superior Court for Santa Cruz County on 701 Ocean Street. And there's plenty of room. We know because last summer we had like up to 80 people spending the night there. So, you know, you can triple that for a rally if people want to come. Food. Great musicians. Tony's going to be there singing. And I think Coral has committed herself to writing up a little bio about each of the musicians.
Well, I know that that Coral Bruno also has a show on Free Radio on Tuesday nights. And she's, I guess that's from 6 to 7, I believe. I'm not sure. Something like that. And she's been, of course, a strong supporter and a co-founder of SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, which is a group that used to take back public spaces that were being denied musicians, homeless people, political tailors, the public generally, under the downtown ordinances by playing every Wednesday night in front
and
of...
by standing out up to the
Market
street gremlins.
Yeah, I mean, and I know that she recently chaired a meeting of the Street Performers Guild, which met at the Sub Rosa, and attempting to deal with issues of the crackdown now on people with electronic keyboards who are suddenly being told that they have to pay $30 for a permit and they can't play except in two locations, and it's not unreasonably disturbing noise. It's another code section of playing without a sound amplification permit. There seems to be a general crackdown on performers, although, we still have people coming out to play, often people who are either just down and dirty and unwilling to stop playing because they feel it's their right. That's usually the 10 o'clock club. JP and Suzanne and Lester and those folks who show up at 10 o'clock in front of the Borders or the former Borders store and play there. Robert Facer is one of them. He's a musician who sings and plays late at night. But during the day, you get other musicians playing. But they're coming to this rally on April 11th at 10 o'clock?
Well, I hope a lot of the street musicians who haven't been contacted will hear your show, because it'd be great if it turned into a real wham jam, and there might be the opportunity for that.
Yeah,
but we're going to be talking about the recent fact of homeless people being closed off from the Armory, which was the closest thing that the upper half of Santa Cruz County has to an emergency shelter, this will shuttle your dependents there, kind of emergency shelter. And so now, what is it? I think you said 180 more people dumped in the streets overnight. I mean, within from Sunday to Monday.
Well, it's, I think it's 75 to 100 people every night who could, in theory, use the armory. There are smaller numbers at the beginning of the month and larger numbers at the end and on nights when there's rainy weather. But it does definitely remove shelter space. And the only space available for people, single people who aren't, you know, in a program of some kind is, I believe, with a few exceptions, the Paul Lee Loft, which has 46 beds. I don't even know if the ISSP...
Well, that's a program.
I don't even know if the ISSP program... Well, they would call the Paul Lee Loft... It is a program in the sense that you get on a waiting list, you get on it, but and you stay there...
And you
there,
have a bunch of rules, and you have a curfew. It's a bunch of crap. The armory, for all its limitations and its fucking mess on the floor, counting as units of bedding... doesn't make too many trips on you once you're there.
Actually, Linda, I've heard otherwise from people going there. They too have rules. For example, it's you can actually get a ride to the Paul Lee Loft. You can't get a ride, for example, up to the armory if you have your own vehicle. You have to get on their bus. You have to get to there. You have to go in at a very early hour, 4 o'clock. I'm not sure what's happening with the Paul Lee Loft, but. I mean, there are unfortunately, all these shelter programs have rules, and in a way, the ISSP program, the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, that used to be the church program where you would be bused to church places, and sometimes you could even go there yourself directly, though not usually. Though we used to call those walk-in emergency shelter because you could go there on the day, stand in line, and actually sometimes get into the shelter. Now, it's not possible anymore, as you say. It's a 30-day program. You're in for 30 days, and you're out for 30 days. You have to wait usually 2 to 6 weeks on the waiting list. Would you say that's accurate?
You're not saying the Armory, but the other program.
Yeah, the Paul Lee Loft is what we're talking. That's the only thing left that the Homeless Service Center runs. I mean, you know, they also have showers, and I believe the lockers. I was told the lockers are being taken out. Maybe they're just being remodeled. I'm not sure what's happening with them. There's a meal twice a day at the Homeless Service Center. The Homeless Service Center also is sort of an umbrella for the Reveille Family Shelter, where if you're a family, you can get in for a longer period of time, and for the River Street Shelter, where you can get in for a 30-day period if you're gone during the day, again, for a very limited number of people.
Can you slow down? Because I know what you're talking about, and I'm even getting confused. I don't think the Homeless Service Center umbrella affects the River Street Shelter. The county... Is its umbrella?
The Homeless Service Center is, I hear you, but the Homeless Service Center is part of the same complex. That is, they're all in the same place.
Yeah, the same building complex.
Right.
Same campus. I call it the homeless ghetto.
I believe they also are combining, I think you get on the waiting list by actually going to the Homeless Service Center's offices, although I could be wrong about that. It certainly, I mean, there are two, apparently if you sign up for either the Homeless Service Center or the River Street Shelter, maybe it's the Paul Lee Loft or the River Street Shelter waiting list, you can then avoid a sleeping ticket or get a sleeping ticket dismissed if you are given a ticket on a date when you are actually on the waiting list. But the Homeless Service Center is not issuing any evidence that you're on that list. You can't, for example, show it to a police officer and say, back off, Mr. Policeman, you know, I'm on a waiting list, so there's no point in ticketing me. Nor have they agreed to call to have somebody who's on call, who the police officer can call and say, you got any places there? No? Okay, well, we're not going to give you a ticket because there's no shelter.
I think the whole system is an obscene abuse of homeless people's values and lives and of the nonprofit system here being cowed along with it. But at this evening's planning meeting for the rally Monday, Casey showed us the letter that some people will get saying that the ticket they already got and already got woke up for and already had their whole fucking day or week screwed up for is dismissed or neutralized or whatever the term. It's an interesting form letter.
Yeah, that's what I understand. And that, of course, was the improvement in the sleeping ban enforcement that was created by people like yourself, Linda, who did this Peace Camp 2010 action that went from July 4th all the way to early September, and that for which you were arrested. Or let's just say you were ticketed, and you are now facing a trial, a misdemeanor trial.
Yeah. For trying to speak out about something in public. you know, the state and their cops clamp down on you just for talking about something or trying to make a sign or trying to get the message out however measly way you can, because they've already shunned you and you didn't go away or die from that. That's my feeling about it.
Well, of course, now, are you feeling, I know you know, your health is not the best, as I understand it.
I'm a crippled woman, and right now I got a cold on top of it.
So,
why?
Well, the reason I mentioned, of course, it's significant that disabled people are being pursued, disabled activists are being pursued, which further impacts, I assume this has some impact on your health.
Well, you know, in my situation, and I think a lot of disabled people, you put yourself in the line of fire, you might get shot. But it's the people that are pushed into having to be invisible who are being made disabled and made sick and made crippled and ultimately dying prematurely, like 20 years prematurely, according to the data, the statistics, because they're trying to keep from becoming a criminal. Because, you know, you can't go on this side of the road and you can't walk on that side of the bike path and you can't sleep on the grass and you can't sleep on the cement. You can't sleep in front of somebody's house, but you can't sleep in the middle of the street. This is killing people, you know? And we have leaders who say, oh, well, they're going out and hide. What's the matter with your friends not going out and hiding? Because it's killing them. So it's making people disabled to have this kind of nonsensical laws so people can keep their fucking noses up in the air about the economy and the country falling apart and kill their neighbor, former neighbors.
And you'll be talking about this issue, I take it, some more, perhaps as the initial speaker on April 11th, Monday, at the county building. I'm hoping you won't just be sitting on the grass, but that you'll be also on the area where people walk back and forth so that, you know, as most rallies are held there. I know the rally that was held last Monday in the afternoon, I actually wasn't at the rally, but I would imagine it was held on the steps where people are, you know, likely to see you as they come and go, much more likely than, let's say, if you're off on the grass.
Well, I don't think we should pick one or the other. You know, I got sore feet. I'm going to be on the grass. But if we have a lot of people that show up, this is the traditional place in our community, in the city of Santa Cruz, that people come to express themselves. It's about the death penalty, whether it's the SEIU workers who are being plucked off like sick chickens from jobs instead of having a say in how they're going to do these drastic layoffs. Whatever your grievance is, it's the courthouse and the county government center. So that's where people go. I hope 400 people are there.
I do, too, although I would be impressed if we got 40 people there, actually.
Homeless people need to see that not everybody in this corrupt town wants them eliminated or disappeared. So I hope some people come. Even if you can't stay, just come over there, walk through the crowd. Say, me too. I'm not one of the people that's trying to knock off the poorest among us. And then go away if you don't want to listen to the music or the speeches or see what kind of food we get.
So this is going to be at 10 o'clock and may go on for a while on Monday the 11th?
Becky was suggesting the musicians hit the notes on the louder ones at 12 so it doesn't bother the courts. But those are pretty insulated glass walls. I think that everyone's going to enjoy the music, and sooner the better.
Mm-hmm. I know that there's another rally coming up on April 9th, which is a rally around new priorities, it's called. It's happening not at the courthouse, but at the town clock. And I'm trying to find it on Indy Bay as I speak.
Yeah, someone invited me to be a speaker at that, too. I don't know about two speeches within the same 3 days.
I hope
trick.
You do.
Tell me some pointers.
You sound pretty articulate, Linda. I don't think you need a lot of help from me, but I mean, you know, you I think you've got it down. The rally is called We Are, let's see if I can find the rally, New Priorities Rally in March, and it is it's happening on the 9th. New Priorities Rally in March. I'm sorry, what were you saying, Linda?
April. This is April.
Am I saying March? Oh, goodness. Thank you. April. I think I made that mistake a couple times. All these things are happening in April, folks. Disregard any of the... substitute April for March when you've... if you're getting, you know, falling asleep and hearing March. It's April 11th. I think I did say April 11th for the rally that you're going to be the keynote speaker at, Linda.
Keynote speaker. And then, I'm going to be the opener.
And the opening speaker, perhaps. And April 9th, the 2 days before, on Saturday. This one, I believe, is at noon, and it's at the town clock. According to this, it says, new priorities means ending the Mideast wars, bringing the troops home, diverting the bloated Pentagon budget to peaceful projects in our own country. Hundreds of billions of those dollars could be better spent developing sustainable alternative energy sources, more efficient homes and vehicles, improving our educational and healthcare system, protecting our environment while providing good jobs for doing all these things. And that's what one description of the rally is. But I also heard from organizer Steve Plaich. He's very concerned, again, about the, he's calling this kind of the vigil against two wars, the war on the poor and the war against people abroad, which is happening in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, and other countries where the U.S. is
and it's a war against our own young men who go into the war to fight because they're being so stretched thin and so abused and coming back so trashed, and they're not even getting a welcome home. So I want to put in a protest against treating our American sons and daughters like disposable ammunition.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I understand the students are gone. Are the students taking a spring break? Is that what's happening right now?
I don't know. After my getting that impression that I found a city on a hill that came out today.
Oh, really? Well, that's interesting. I know we're hoping that someone would be able to put a notice about these rallies in City on a Hill. Did that happen? Or
it didn't happen. It's fun. There's some great articles. It's a great thing about vinyl coming back for music, and there's a good number of things about art and artists in this new issue of City on a Hill Press.
Nothing about these two rallies. That's too bad. Well, I'll be mentioning them, and hopefully other people on the free radio stream, we're not broadcasting, as I said before, but on the stream will be happening. We're talking with Linda LeMaster. Linda, you've been around for decades in Santa Cruz. Have you seen, and at one time you were, of course, chair of the Homeless Issues Task Force. You were chair of the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women. You founded, or you were one of the, I think you were the founder of the, Welfare Mothers Support Group, which became the Welfare Parents Support Group.
Yeah, really it was founded by three women ahead of me, and I got in on one of their last support groups. And then when it came back, I was one of the ringleaders, and ultimately five of us who've been around a long time and still are incorporated it so that we were able to actually not just organize peer support projects, but actually help each other and get resources
now,
for
still,
other welfare mothers.
Is it still going, or what's happened to it?
No, it evolved into something called We Listen. It stands for Welfare and Low Income Support Network. And I had to leave because there was a conflict over money that I felt breached some contracts that I'd helped to win. So I had to get out of the way of the fallout at some point. But, you know, housing now in Santa Cruz, which was one of its many umbrella projects, is still going on.
Well, that's good news. How can people get involved with that?
Well, come to the rally. Hopefully I'll have a little handout about it. It's kind of hard to put in words on the radio, but, you know, it has a mission and a purpose and some contact information. And basically what we do besides try to keep the information and help people with administrative problems with bureaucracies is create opportunities for homeless and unhomeless volunteers to do things together, whether it's like a trip to the movies or actually trying to change the sleeping ban, it doesn't matter what, but we try to provide a kind of nest or infrastructure for people that want to work together that way in small groups.
Now, you were involved with Project Connect, the group that kind of, you know,
Project Homeless Connect?
Correct. They got together at the Civic Auditorium. Don Lane, I think, was a big cheese there, Vice Mayor Don Lane, a couple of Tuesdays ago. A lot of people, and there were some services provided to homeless people on this once-a-year, maybe it's now twice-a-year event. What was
it's
your...
once-a-year. Project Homeless Connect Santa Cruz is annual, and the event you're talking about recently was the second annual one. I was very impressed that we did as good locally as we had done the first year, with a little underwriting from the census.
So tell me about the good things that came out of Project Connect and its limitations as well.
I can't do that off the cuff. I thought they did a good job, and, of course, I'm kind of moved to the quick. Whenever I see homeless and not homeless people in large numbers actually congregating together, whether they're actually solving problems and creating alliances and helping each other or not. But I noticed that the Good Times wrote an article in it last week's Good Times, a little review of it, lost an opportunity to have some good pictures. But they gave the Huff musicians a plug. They didn't mention Huff, but they noted the good music outside. Did you read that?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, I thought it was a very short article, so I thought it was significant that the musicians were picked up on. But, you know, they do things there that you don't find anywhere else in the community, like have a community meal where you can talk to people across the table. And this is inclusive, and it doesn't cost any money once you get there.
What are you talking about, the Project Connect or...?
At the Homeless Connect has a big meal for everyone.
Yeah, what I remember, of course, I guess what I remember most sharply about that, although I think I ate some of the food and it was quite tasty, given to me by one of the servers there, was a one of the volunteers who helped with Huff, who was involved, I guess Diane her name was, who wanted to, she was a student from UCSC. She was very put off by the way the volunteers sort of commandeered and shoveled homeless people around, wouldn't let them get their own food, directed them here and there, treated them sort of like invalids.
I have a problem with that, too, as a disabled person. It's like when you're trying to move people like cattle, this happens to anybody, no matter what you're training. I think you start thinking that everybody can move at the same velocity. Then you start thinking, oh, you got to get them to move a little faster. And in a crowded situation, when everybody's there and the chairs are full, you know, people need to slow down from their normal momentum, not speed up.
Well, I think
so
it was
that's
more...
just a traffic problem.
Well,
I didn't see anyone complain, so I'm glad to hear this.
Yeah, no, it wasn't the traffic. It was the fact that when an individual tried to get his own food, he was chastised for doing that, told to go and sit down, given instructions on how to behave to get his little bit of meal. And that was something apparently that offended her. I've actually played that interview on the radio. But, I didn't
see... Well, you're right. It's just like when they have a Thanksgiving meal at a vet call, when there used to be a vet call for people. They hand you a plate of food. They want to serve you. There's a certain magic in that. And some things are set up like a buffet. And I think it wastes less food when people can serve themselves. But in a big setting where you're planning to feed 400 people or whatever, or more, you got to go with the flow and as best you can. And then we, people like you and me, have to work to make it become more capable of doing it, whichever way it chooses.
Yeah, I think I'll take Diana's position more than yours. But I appreciate your perspective.
But what are you going to do with her position?
We're talking
with... We got to make this known.
Hey, I'm not going to argue with you about it. I just take her position. We're talking with activist Linda LeMaster, who's going to court for trial on the Peace Camp 2010
May 4th.
You know, jail train or whatever. And at least you have your own independent attorney, Jonathan Gettleman, as I understand it.
Yay,
who I spoke to today, by the way. He seems...
Oh, good.
Yeah, he's optimistic about jury instructions, but that's another detail. Linda, anything else you want to say before I roll into the next segment of the show?
No, just April 9th, April 11th, be there or be square.
April 9th, of course, is noon at the town clock. That's Saturday for the protest for new priorities, where I guess you'll be speaking, and hopefully one of those new priorities will be a different priority for homeless people. And then there's the April 11th rally at the courthouse.
Sponsored by
Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is at the 701 Ocean Street at the courthouse at 10 o'clock in the morning. Free food by Joe Schultz, the Jumbo Gumbo Man, who may be coming up with some breakfast stuff.
Oh,
I'm hoping
wonderful.
He can provide coffee cake, maybe, and coffee.
That's
and
wonderful.
So if you want
coffee,
it
will help homeless people want to be there.
Maybe.
Coffee. That's wonderful. What an honor.
Well, thank
you,
Linda.
So but tell them how to get in touch with us, and let's say there's a few more volunteers that want to jump in Monday morning.
Well, of course, you can come on Monday morning and help out. Huff has regular meetings every Wednesday, which isn't really helping in this, terms of this rally. But Huff meets every Wednesday at 10:30 at the Sub Rosa Cafe. And if we're not meeting there, look for a sign on the door, the closed, locked door, to see where we are meeting. It's always a great challenge and a mystery where we go to, often to the Saturn Cafe, sometimes the Bagelary. But we do meet regularly every Wednesday at 10:30. And then, of course, you can call the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will eventually get back to you once I pick up your message.
And for getting educated about homeless issues is Huff Yahoo Group.
Right. Well, if you go to the Huff website, you can go to huffsantacruz.org, and that website is currently under repair and construction and hopefully updating, although we're having some problems with that. But you can see a lot of sort of historical stuff about homeless issues on the Huff website. And if you want to be on the Huff email list, you should email me, rnorse3@hotmail.com, and I'll put you on. You get our, I'd say, 5 or 10 or 15 missives every week, sometimes less, sometimes more, usually less. Thank you, Linda, for calling in.
Yeah, short ones and sometimes some analysis. Thank you.
All right.
For the interview.
Oh, you take care, babe.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And phone lines are open, 427-3772 is the call-in number. I'm going to do a little musical break, and I'll be back, and we'll be talking some more about kind of stuff we've been talking about for the last hour. Police misconduct in Santa Cruz, the drug war, homeless problems, and the possibility of constitutional uprising by the community to just say no to criminalization of poor people. Having a little problem here with this. I'm not sure why. Ah, I think I see why. Don't go away, folks. That was another one from Ann Feeney, and that one was called Your Mind is on Vacation. On the line with us now is Angel from Felton. Hi, Angel.
Hello, how you doing?
And welcome back to Free Radio. I know we talked a week ago on the air. You were in the studio with Jack Smith and a couple of his friends and your friends.
Yes, I was.
And I'm looking over the Santa Cruz Urinal, actually the Santa Cruz Sentinel, as I call it.
You said it the right way.
Yeah, unfortunately. There's a story there. Owner of suspected drug house in Felton pleads not guilty to ammunition charges. The owner of a suspected drug house in Felton pleaded not guilty Monday to a charge of being a felon in possession of ammunition. Jack Smith, 74, his attorney Joseph Barrera entered the plea in Superior Court. Judge Ariadne Simon set a preliminary hearing for May 2nd. On February 22nd, Smith was a passenger in a silver Ford Bronco near Kirby and Gushy Streets in Felton. Sergeant Mark Yanez said in February, Smith's partner, 53-year-old Edwina Hardy, was driving. Deputies pulled over the Bronco because it had a temporary registration sticker on it, deputies said. Search of the vehicle yielded 18 grams of cocaine, 13 grams of meth, packaged for sale, a scale, and $700 cash. Hardy was arrested on suspicion of possessing drugs for sale and transporting them. The Bronco was registered to Smith and Hardy. Deputies searched their motorhome on the 100 block of Kirby Street and found ammunition for several guns of different calibers, Yanez said, but no guns were found. And Smith, previously convicted of felony drug charges many years ago, as I understand it, said he was arrested because he was not allowed to possess ammunition. He owns a home in Felton, the center of neighborhood complaints because of blight and alleged drug activity. A judge ordered the home to be vacated March 30th because of code violations, and that actually was the story that I probably should have read, because it was really the story that you were kind of anticipating. You guys were all going to go to court last week, and you were going to talk about, you know, what I guess they're claiming code violations on this Felton house. Jack claimed that this ammunition was old and rusty and had been left there by a previous person that had nothing to do with anything that he was doing, and this old felony was what, some decades old or something, or.
It's over 50 years old.
How old?
Over 50 years old.
The felony or the ammunition?
The felony and with the ammunition was just what they got him for when they arrested him this time. And the his felony is over 50 years old.
I'm sorry, what was over 50 years old? His
felony.
The felony. What was the felony?
Right now at the moment, I can't remember what it was, but he'll be here shortly, and he can talk to you, too.
Yeah, I mean, Jack is 74 or thereabouts?
Yeah, he's 74.
And so this happened when he was in his 20s, and they're talking about this. Has he been convicted of anything since then?
No, he hasn't.
Now, there's been this a lot of, he's been pointing out, there's been controversy around his house up in Felton, which is actually near that stoplight where Highway 9 and the house is. Yeah, there's where this is kind of the only stoplight in Felton. Well, that's in the middle of the Felton area, where Highway 9 intersects, I guess, with Empire Grade Road.
Yes.
And the decision. Judge orders suspected drug house in Felton to be vacated. This was a decision that was made apparently in Jack's absence. Because
we had an ex parte hearing supposed to be on the 30th at 1 o'clock. Well, they happened to have the ex parte at 8:30 in the morning when they have a written paper from the court where they have the instructions on how to do ex partes and where they have them done. And they have also written there every Monday through Friday at 1 o'clock ex parte court hearings.
You're talking about the ex parte court hearings, where what that means is that the one party comes in alone to the court hearing without the other party necessarily having to be present.
Everyone has to be there.
And say that again?
Everybody has to be there.
To an ex parte hearing? I wasn't aware of that.
Everybody has to be there. The ones that filed this complaint and the ones that defended, they have to be there, and the plaintiffs have to be there. And it also is written in this paper, a document that I have, that they also have to, that Mr. Smith has to also be there also. but they changed the time to 8:30 on the 30th. He didn't know. And then at 12 o'clock, they were coming and putting the locks on the door where they could not go inside the house, just on the property, but not inside the house or anywhere around. And then that was at 12. They knew he had to be at court at 1, so we got him to court, and there was nobody doing anything. So I went into the judge's chambers and talked to the secretary there, and she called the judge, and the judge said that they had it at 8:30. Well, didn't nobody tell us, and ain't nobody supposed to be changing the exportation time until they let somebody know. And also, I went through the file that they had been done on him on the 30th, and they got they have written in the statement that, let me see, I got the paper right here, that this was written on March the 30th, but they had got it written that on March the 20th, before the Honorable Timothy R. Volkman in Department 4 of the above entitled court, plaintiff appeared by counsel Tamara Rice. Defendants failed to appear. Okay, March the 20th is on a Sunday.
So you've got two concerns, it sounds like, or at least there are two issues you raise. One is that the original ex parte hearing last Wednesday, or a week ago Wednesday, I guess it would be now, was supposedly supposed to be at 1 o'clock or 1:30. I'm not sure. What time was it?
They were supposed to start at 1:15, but everybody had to be there at 1.
So at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but in fact, the date or the time was changed. It was the same date, but to an earlier time, without informing Jack Smith, so he wasn't available for the hearing.
That's right.
And his
at
house.
8:30.
And his house was locked up and shut down in order by Judge. I guess it was Judge Volkman.
Judge Timothy R. Volkman. Yes, sir.
Right. It was shut down on the claim that. That there were 16 arrests there, that there were, because there was blight and unsafe building conditions, and only the people working to upgrade the property could be there. And I want to know what impact that's had on Jack and what people are doing, but I also want to follow up on this issue that you've raised. Did Jack demand, or Jack's attorney demand, that there be a rehearing with him present? Although, as I said before, my understanding of ex parte hearings is, you know, you can be there, but ex parte doesn't mean it's it's a regular hearing. But anyway, whatever that is, he certainly, it sounds strange or actually ominous that he was, you know, not informed of the change in time. Has there been an official order requested that this be reheard?
He's been talking to his lawyer, and his lawyer is supposed to be doing that now. As you know, it's supposed to be done that, but ain't nobody told us anything yet. But right now, I'm working on doing. I tried to get an attorney because we're going to go and do some legal work of our own on them.
About legal work about what?
By the way, they have treated Mr. Smith.
Right. Although it's really hard. It's really hard to hold judges accountable, I'll tell you. They're not liable for anything.
It's the judges I'm after. It's the policemen. It's Ross and Yancey and the rest of them that's with him.
So the other issue you raised was that Judge Volkman on March 20th claimed that Smith was not present on March 20th, which would be not unusual because March 20th, you say, if you're accurate here, is a Sunday.
It's a Sunday. I'm looking at the calendar now. Yes,
now,
it's a Sunday.
And Judge Volkman make this claim, and what was the significance of this claim? In what context was he saying this, and what did it mean?
Okay, this right here was written. Okay, the file date that it had stamped by the Alex Calvo, I guess, is a clerk.
Right.
On March the 30th, 2011, it's got filed, and that's when it was filed, on March the 30th.
What was filed?
The filed at the Superior Court of California County of Santa Cruz with a preliminary injunction.
So there's a preliminary. This was the injunction that Volkman. I thought he ordered that. That was the injunction that was ordered when Jack Smith was not in court. Correct.
Right.
When he thought that the hearing was at 1 o'clock and it was actually at 8:30.
Right. And this was signed. And see, this has got to be typed up, as I think. It's typed up before the judge signs it. And he's supposed to read it before he signs it, as I've always heard. I don't know. But evidently, if he read this, he would have seen that March the 20th, as a friend of mine says, it could be a typo, or it might be, but it's not. Hey, it's a mistake that the judge made in reading it.
Well, was Smith, was it important that... Was the document claiming that he had not appeared at a prior hearing and that was an element in Judge Volkman's decision to grant the injunction?
No, he's always been to every one of the hearings that they've had, and this is the only one that he had not been to because they had turned around and told us one. They turned around and had the meeting at 8:30. At 12 o'clock, they were at the house putting locks on the doors. All of them come running up and down putting locks on the doors.
I hear you. Now, but what I'm saying, though, is... It was Volkman's order in mentioning this March 20th thing, was that another alleged hearing, or was he just misstating the March 30th hearing date?
Well, March 30th.
I see. So he meant March 30th, but somebody wrote March 20th.
Well, it was typed up March 20th, for sure.
So what's Jack doing? I mean, is anybody staying on the property, or has it all been essentially abandoned, or what's going on up there?
Nobody's staying on the property right now. But here is Mr. Smith to talk to you also.
Okay. Sounds good, Angel.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
Hey, Jack. So we're talking with Jack Smith, who's a resident of Felton, kind of, although you've just been sort of ousted from your house, right?
Yeah, I've been hung. So you didn't leave that town meeting. It was unbelievable.
Well, you talk about the meeting before the injunction was granted?
Oh, yes, yeah.
So tell us about that, and tell us about how things went when you went to the court. What happened when you said to the judge and the clerks, "Hey, I was here. I was told it was at 1 o'clock, and you know, suddenly you did it at 8:30." What did they say to you?
Well, basically, I kind of felt something was funny because Ross rousted me early in the morning to serve me that paper, right? And he had to have it by a certain length of time, but he didn't say the time had changed.
So
from 1 o'clock, which all the parte hearings are at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and this thing was moved at, I guess, 8:30.
Did you receive notice in that paper from Deputy Ross that it was at 8:30, or was
well,
there no...
I don't believe it has any indication whatsoever. Yeah, again, you know, I don't even remember what I read most of the time anymore, but to my knowledge, it did not.
So and, did you bring this attention to the attention of the clerks of the court when you went down there?
Well, we haven't had... Rob says he did, but... We didn't bring it to the judge's attention because we're going to petition for another parte hearing.
I see.
Because what they've done, in any event, the situation is this, that they have got me locked out of the house. There's food in there rotten in the refrigerator. He didn't, when Ross took over with his henchmen, they were basically out the door we go. Most of the people had a hard time getting them whatever they could carry, you know. They just ousted everybody in the building. So what they've done, they put me in a position with absolutely no income in that building and a $4,000 a month payment, you know, that I cannot carry. So that's where I'm at, basically. And then when we're working around there, a couple deputies may show up. One night where they're moving things around and cleaning up till it was after dark. And, you know, we moved the trailer. The guy next door is lying through his teeth. They said they had, somebody told me, it was in the paper, they had rats coming out of that trailer as big as squirrels. And that is BS. There wasn't a rat in that. But besides, I got daikon around on the rafters around that place. Every time it rains a lot because it's high land, there is rats that appear on it, getting out of the water. But,
There are still people on the property working on the code violations, or has that stopped as well?
Oh, well, actually, we're working on it. yet. We're doing what we can with the limited money and whatnot and time we have available to bring it up to where maybe the neighborhood would be a little more pleased. But, my God, the guy next door is doing all the complaining. His hedge fell over in our area, right? And I knocked on his door and said, hey, if you want, we'll help you clean it up. I got plenty of help here right now because it took up a parking spot that we needed. He said, oh, I'll get it. But the stuff was wet and soggy. It was heavy. But we managed to roll it up after we cut it out and put it on the dump trailer. And then as soon as it was dry enough, you got to bear in mind, it's rained so much that a two-wheel truck has a hard time pulling a good-sized trailer around in that muddy landfill.
So what is this? Was this before or after the injunction was granted?
Well, that was after.
But that was, of course, legal. That was legal for you to do because you're allowed to have workers on the property working on these violations, right?
Right. But Ross don't want us there.
Deputy Ross. Sheriff's Deputy Ross.
Yeah, Sergeant Ross.
Sergeant Ross.
He kind of runs the valley.
So what has he done to try to discourage people from being on the property recently?
Well, he's the Ross, practically. You know, what are you doing here? And so does his deputies. Now, the other night we were in the back working, and in come two deputies. And they shined a light right in my eyes, and I looked at him and I said, Officer, if you don't mind, you can remove that from my eyes. You know who I am. And he didn't. He just kept shining it, you know. So I have one in my hand. I shined it in his eyes. He said, get that out of my eyes. I saw it's like a little gunfight here. You take it out of my eyes, too, you know. But anyway, I was just kidding around. But in any event, they're extremely rude. It's like you're in Nazi Germany, man. It's, these guys are skinheads, and they're just grossly abusive.
Well, what was the purpose of the deputies coming on your property? What did they claim they wanted?
Very wrong. They want to know what we're doing. I said, what does it look like we're doing? We're working.
And did they then leave?
No. Not right away, but they did eventually. Yeah.
Huh.
But they have no right. There was that no trespassing signs that we got the backyard locked up and, you know, with locks because I've lost one air compressor. And not being able to stay there at night, my stuff's dwindling. There's three bicycles missing. So it's, you know, one of them is worth $2,200. I believe the guy found it.
Now, is a caretaker on the property allowed to stay there, or you essentially have to everybody has to leave at night?
They want everybody out of it because there's people next door call in and say, there's somebody over there. There's somebody over there. There's people over there. You know, stuff like that.
So. Now, do you have any allies among any of the neighbors?
Tell you the truth, I don't believe so. Yeah, some of them have came out and talked to me. But that's a shame what they're doing. I can't believe it. Because I've improved that property in those 18 years. It has never been painted in the last 15 or 20, and we did an awesome paint job. We poured concrete sidewalks around. And, you know, this during this big course of rain, I've had a flooding problem because the drains were stopped up. We put in, you know, you want to talk? Come on. I think Rob's got some, you know, Rob, he's got some things.
Sure.
Like
Before you go, Jack, we're talking with Jack Smith up at, who's been notorious in the papers as that fair-haired, white-haired guy who's being removed from his property for alleged violations, property violations, and then allegedly this drug, the drug house stuff. So the 16 arrests for the drug bus, how many of them resulted in convictions, if any?
None that I know of. Basically, they're harassing the old man there, damn near as old as I am, old Raybo. They want to he his debt to society. He has no search and seizure or none of that stuff hanging over his head. And he basically stands his ground because he knows his rights. So he's not giving them a bottle.
Have there been 16 arrests since February on your property for drug activity?
Not at all. That's all BS. Rats feed all this stuff to the Sentinel. And they print just about anything that anybody says, especially him. But there's been so many misrepresentations. Like, for example, the Valley Press comes out. I apparently was violating my parole. I've never been in prison. I did have a felony 20 years ago.
or something like that. But anyway, my memory really is bad. If I tell you 20, it could have been 30, you know. So
yeah, actually, we've talked about this, Jack, in the past in the studio. Is there something Rob wanted to say before we sign off? Let me ask, what's the next court date? Before he does, what's the next court date coming up, or the next date that people should be aware of?
We're going to try to get an ex parte hearing here in the middle of the first part of next week. I got a contractor coming in that's going to go on the permit. So they won't let me do the work. I only had a maintenance business place for 20 years, and I will probably work on your house. I don't know. You know, K-Wells, I maintained wells for years.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to get a better phone connection, because it's really hard to understand some of what you're saying. But if you do have a hearing coming up, call on Sunday, because I do a show Sunday morning, and let us know when that is, and we can pass that on to people in case they want to attend the hearing. Although, if they change the time on us, we may not be able to come to the hearing.
And that's kind of hard to make when you show up, you know. But here's Robin. Sure, pleasure to talk to you again.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jack. Talking with Jack Smith. Now talking with...
Rob, how you doing?
Who's this?
Rob.
Hey, Rob. What's happening? I know you were in the studio before. And were you living on Jack's property before they cleared everybody away?
No.
Was that a no?
Yes, that's a no.
Yes, that's a no. Okay. And so what have you got to tell us? Because I'm gonna roll on you pretty quickly here.
Okay, well, they didn't give us the wrong time. The clerk did when he came out, told us 1:30, but it was at 1 o'clock, it was at 8:30, so we're going to file for a to set aside.
I got that.
So we could be heard. Also, at the town meeting, it was pretty one-sided. I've never seen it. I think what they're going to do next is, after they're finished with Jack, they're going to go after the homeless.
Yeah, that's, of course, something that I'm concerned about. And Angel talked a bit about that when she was on the show, or actually when she talked to me on the phone about it. I'm gonna leave it here for the moment. I'll give you the last word. And I'll encourage you or Jack or Angel to get back to me on Sunday and give us any updates that have happened. The real issue, is the claims, unfortunately, that the Sentinel has made. If they're true or false, if they're false, we want to know specifically how it's hard to disprove a false claim because it's like trying to prove a negative, but they claim 16 drug arrests. They claim significant code violations. I don't want to talk about this now because you guys talked about it on the air already and at some length. But maybe we'll talk about it again on Sunday, particularly if these issues are coming up in a court hearing. And in the meantime, let me know how you think people can help out.
Okay, well, they got to be aware that this kind of what's going on here can happen to them, and you can't believe everything you read. It's one-sided. There's not been no proof of any sales activity or manufacturing activity going on at that house at all. All they've had was some people that were arrested for. Various offenses that Jack had nothing to do with. And some of the arrests have counted twice.
Okay. What can people do to help out?
Well, if they have another town meeting, show support for Mr. Smith. And maybe some letters of support to... the supervisor, Mark Stone, who seems to believe only the cops' version of what's going on, he was pretty much made his side clear. And maybe write some letters to the sheriff's office saying that they don't appreciate this kind of abuse of power.
Well, I appreciate that, Rob. And is there a phone number that people can call if they want to contact you for more information?
Yeah, it's 831-247-5951.
All right, that's 831-247-5951.
Yes.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Angel. And thank you, Jack, for coming on the air again.
Okay, nice talking to you.
Hey, good talking to you guys.
Have a good trip. We'll see you.
All righty. Bye-bye. And phone lines are open. 427-3772 is the call-in number. You're tuned to the stream of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. The last 15 minutes, we're going to continue the discussion about the the bust of the Jabberwock. We'll hopefully have an update on the Smith drug house, so-called drug house stuff, which Jack and Angel and Ron, Rob, and others living there are contesting, and other issues. I'm going to take another one of those musical breaks, and I'm going to try to play a little from a Roger Mensch's interview, if I can find it, which may be a little difficult, but see if I can. Roger is a man who has sold medical marijuana through the Hemporium and has finally conceded in the third of a series of long prosecutions, which are, again, part of the drug war against marijuana, and it's another defeat for all of us, I think. Too bad if we have to talk about it or rehear about it, but we probably need to. Let's catch a little music first, though.
Dutchman's not the kind of man to keep his thumb jammed in the dam that holds his dreams in. That's a secret that only Margaret knows. And Amsterdam is golden in the summer. Margaret brings him breakfast. Tulips bloom beneath the snow. He's mad as he can be, but Margaret only sees that sometimes. Sometimes she sees her unborn children in his eyes. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the sea. Long ago, I used to be a young man, and dear Margaret remembers that for me. The Dutchman still wears wooden shoes, his cap and coat are patched with loveless. Margaret sewed there. Sometimes he thinks he's back in Rotterdam. He watches the tugboats down the canal, calls out to them when he thinks he knows the captain. Till Margaret comes to lead him home again, through unforgiving streets that trip him, though she holds his arm. Sometimes he thinks he's alone and he calls her name. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the cider sea. Long ago, I used to be a young man, and dear Margaret remembers that for me. The winter swirls the windmills round, winds his muffler tighter. They sit in the kitchen. Some tea with whiskey keeps away the dew. For a moment, calls her name. She makes the bed up, singing some old love song. A song Margaret learned when it was very new. He hums a line or two, and they sing together in the dark. The Dutchman falls asleep, and Margaret blows the candle out. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the cider sea. Long ago, I used to be a young man,
That was Anne Feeney from her album, If I Can't Dance, It's Not My Revolution, and that's The Dutchman. You tune to the stream of freakradio.org. Maybe soon we'll be hearing the actual broadcast again. I'm sorry this is so late. We have about 12 minutes left. I'm going to play some of the interview with Hemporium activist Roger Mensch, who also formed a chapter of Americans for Safe Access in the last year and has been struggling to decriminalize marijuana, make it available to medical patients, and fight unjust prosecutions and persecutions against him. Without any further ado, here's an interview I had with him. It was either today or yesterday up in Felton. We have to first slow down the tape a bit, and then we'll do it.
I'm talking with Roger Mensch, who is the has owned and run the Hemporium, which is a medical marijuana dispensary in the Felton area. And Roger has been twice pursued by Santa Cruz district attorney authorities and sheriffs for selling marijuana, allegedly to non-patients or out-of-the-county patients. Or those were previous cases, right, Roger?
Well, I'm not sure what case. Which case you're talking about?
The previous two busts that you had to do with Hemporium sales to either out-of-state people or people without cards.
No, all my sales were to people that had medical marijuana cards, and they were all in the state.
Well, what were you accused of?
On the first case, second case, or third case?
First and second.
Well, both of them was charged with sales, cultivation, and cultivation and sales.
To people with medical marijuana cards, or did they claim they didn't have cards?
They all had medical marijuana cards. Even the undercover in my third case went out and got a valid recommendation, supposedly a valid recommendation, and then arrested me after.
What was the basis on which the two cases were pursued, that even if you have such a card, that such dispensaries are illegal unless you are an immediate caregiver? Was that the claim?
It's different. The first case, we went with a caregiver defense, and they denied me that defense. And then, the appellate court ruled that I should have been allowed it and reversed my conviction. And the Supreme Court ruled that, no, I'm still convicted. And so the second case...
Before you go on to the second case, so the conviction was based on the fact that you were selling marijuana to people with cards, but that was still not enough, or recommendations, because the very act of selling was itself illegal?
Well...
What was their claim? In other words, why? On what basis did they say, I mean, they don't go after Wham, they don't go after Greenway, this sell to people, why would they go after you? What was their specific claim of the difference in your case?
Well, they didn't give me no difference in cases. They have gone after Wham, right? They've gone after them, but...
The local DA, I'm not sure that he has. The feds have, I know that. The local DA has.
Yes, yeah, the local DA has a couple times. But that's all evidently resolved, with the federal case and all that. My case, was a huge issue of trying to allow a caregiver to sell to patients like the 215 provided.
And were they claiming you were making undue profits? I mean, again, I'm trying to understand if there is any difference, or was simply they decided to go after you because they didn't like the way you looked, or they didn't like the way, in other words, my impression was they were selectively prosecuting you, but I was trying to understand things from their perspective. What would they have said was the difference in your case between that and anybody else? Why do they claim that even if you're selling to people with cards, it's illegal? What is their claim?
Well, back in 2003, they said, the DA actually said to one of the patients after my court case, they said they didn't want anybody making money off of marijuana.
Now, were you making profits off this?
I was making reasonable compensation. Right?
You weren't profiteering by your perspective.
No, I wasn't. No.
Did they claim you were? Did they present evidence that you were making large amounts of profits?
Well, they're trying to say, you know, they even said, oh, he's got a flat screen TV, mm-hmm. right? A 23-inch flat screen TV. And then they said, oh, he's got a BMW. Well, it was a 1996 BMW. And, you know, they froze my bank accounts, and they got like $1,400. They did the same thing in this last case, right? And they came up with the same thing.
As I understand it, it does require a lot of money to actually purchase marijuana and make it available, so that does involve money, but it doesn't necessarily involve money that you profit from. Is that accurate? In other words, you have to actually purchase marijuana, which is expensive, from people in different areas, or grow it yourself if you have that capability, which isn't always the case here in this area. And in that cost, that involves a certain amount of capital. And the claim can be made by the DA, well, see all the money that's involved, but in fact, it's involved in getting the product essentially to the patients, and you are making only reasonable compensation, if you follow my point.
Yeah, I follow what you're saying. Yeah, I had huge overhead. My electric bill was $3,800 a month.
You were growing your own?
Yes. Yeah, I was growing my own, and it was for the collective as well.
And so eventually, the first charge... You were convicted on the first charge and sentenced to jail. The first round of the first case.
The first case, you know, I wasn't allowed a caregiver's defense by Judge Stevens, and so it went to the appellate court, and all three judges ruled in my favor, reversed my conviction, and they certified it for publication, so other people could use it. And then it went up to the state Supreme Court. And that little word consistently in the law, where if you're a caregiver, you got to consistently take care of a person, either in health, safety, or housing. And under those rules, they denied me a caregiver's defense, said that I shouldn't have been allowed one in the first place, and then I was reconvicted.
And so in other words, the same kind of... was there a second defense you could have used in that case rather than the caregiver's defense that would have gotten you a not guilty plea, do you think?
Yeah, it's possible because I had set up the Emporium as a business, trying to stay within the law any which way I could. And, you know, at that time, I went with the instructions of my attorneys or suggestions of my attorneys, and they believed that the caregiver defense would be the best one at that time.
Who was your attorney?
Well, I had numerous public defenders, but it ended up being Amy Buontello from the public defender's office, but there was help from other attorneys as well.
The reason I'm questioning about this is because obviously there's no consistent caregiver activity from either Greenway or Glimekiln, the two monopoly marijuana distribution centers downtown. Could they be prosecuted similarly, or would they have a second defense other than the caretaker defense? Sounds like the caretaker defense wouldn't work with them. Is there a collective defense where they say, we're just running a collective, it's not a caretaker operation?
Well, my understanding is the clubs in the city, you know, they would like to go after them, but politically it would be, I think, damaging, and that's one of the reasons why they haven't pursued it. But, you know, it's like the people have voted in medical marijuana. The police need to stop for pursuing the patients and the collectives and destroying people's lives.
Oh, for sure. But the question, I guess the answer then is they wouldn't have any additional defense. Although I think when I talked to Pebbles Trippett up in Mendocino, she seemed to feel that recent court decisions do give them a defense, even if they are not providing consistent care, that they have some other defense. The clubs throughout the state may have that defense, but the district attorney's office, when I talked to them 3 or 4 years ago, said we regard all clubs as illegal. Maybe a collective like WAM isn't, because they grow for themselves, but clubs generally that sell to even to people with medical marijuana cards and recommendations are themselves illegal. And DA Bobley seemed surprised to hear that when his one of his DAs said that in my presence, because obviously it contradicts the tolerance policy they have towards Lyme killed in Greenway in Santa Cruz. And you're saying, it sounds like to me, that's because of political factors rather than any consistent standard or additional standard in the law.
I don't know anything about the standards or anything that the city does with those people.
The DA isn't going after them, and they're doing what sounds like something very equivalent to what you were doing. So I'm just suggesting the reason they may not be is because of a political factor rather than, oh, they're operating differently, they're using a different defense. In other words, I'm not aware that there's a different defense they're using, but I'm wondering if maybe there is that we're not getting into. But the second case, what was a similar case?
Well, it's the first case. Let's go back to the first case, you know, or the other clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a lot of money to fight. Where I, you know, the little people don't have money to fight the big system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, my understanding over the hill in San Jose, they're considering all the clubs illegal over there, and it's actually the law is very, very unclear. It's terrible the way the law's been put together here to where. Or, you know, they need to stop the police from attacking the patients, man. This is crazy. This is like prohibition days, right? And, you know, it's basically they still want to say that marijuana doesn't have any medical value, right? But the proof is coming out.
Well, Reefer Madness has proved that it drives people crazy, right?
Exactly.
And a documentary film was put out some time ago. I mean, why don't you simply get what? I see you have your marijuana T-shirt on there, Mensch. I mean, good grief. Anyway, what was the first case you were sentenced to jail?
Yeah, I was sentenced to 5 days time served when I was convicted. My second case, I spent 7 days in jail, and that was thrown out because I won. The appellate court came in with this decision, so they decided to drop the charges.
What was the decision of the appellate court that made them drop the charges or that persuaded them?
Well, I won.
What basis did you win?
The appellate court said that I should have been given a caregiver defense. I should have been allowed a caregiver's defense.
And this was before the Supreme Court had ruled that reversed the earlier decision?
Yeah, well, you got to go through the appellate court before you get to the Supreme Court, right? So,
But the case of the Supreme Court was in the first case, right?
Yeah.
And so that hadn't reached the Supreme Court when the second case was thrown out?
No. In 2006, the appellate court came back with a decision, and I was going into my trial in October of 2006, and at that time
in the second case
they overruled, they reversed my conviction. I was found not guilty, so they dropped the charges, marijuana charges, in my second case, but they're still holding me for probation violations for that case, as well as in my first case, I had some guns and ammo around, and they left ammo at the house from the first time they arrested me.
Mm-hmm.
So when they came the second time, they got me on a probation violation of a felon in possession of bullets, which they left there purposely. I think it's a trick that they do so they can come back and violate somebody on probation.
How can you say that about our deputies, Roger?
Yeah, right.
So in the third case, it wasn't the district attorney's office locally that went after you. It was the Santa Clara County?
It was both the Santa Cruz Narcotics Task Force and the San Jose, it's called the I don't know, they have a task
group over there.
They have a task force over there that's state. It's a state organization that pays, but it's local police that are involved in it.
But the district attorney of Santa Cruz wasn't involved. It was the district attorney of one of the counties of San Jose or Santa Clara.
And I think there's a whole bunch of district attorneys involved. When I was arrested, the cop's phone just kept ringing off the hook, and I was asking who it was. And he said, oh, it's all these DAs calling in saying, oh, you got Mensch under arrest? And, you know, it's like...
You think that Bob Lee might have been involved?
No, I Bob Lee, you know, I don't... Bob Lee has nothing to me to fucking do with this, right? It's...
Well, his office prosecuted you twice, though.
Yeah, it's his office, right? But it's... I don't want to even go into that part of it,
okay.
Right? I don't want to go after...
Okay.
Right? The...
We'll hear more defense of the innocent Bob Lee on Sunday when I resume this tape. This is an interview with Roger Mensch, who founded the Hemporium up in Felton, and that one closed down, and now he's, well, he, I think he